Welcome and Happy New Year. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. As we kick off our first week of shows in 2017, we are beginning a week-long series discussing how ordinary citizens, activists, and grassroots organizations are preparing to resist Donald Trump and his party's extreme agenda. Donald Trump has promised to get rid of regulations, deport undocumented immigrants, pack the Supreme Court with anti-abortion justices, repeal Obamacare, expand oil and gas drilling. The list goes on. Today, we are joined by two guests. Reverend James Forbes is the Senior Emeritus Minister of the Riverside Church in New York. He's also co-chair of the Moral Revival. This is a national tour that was launched to advance a broad social justice agenda that centers on five key issues areas, including the economic liberation of all people, access to quality education for every child, and healthcare access for all. Last year, members traveled to over 20 states to discuss these issues. Hi, Reverend Forbes. Welcome to the show.
How are you? Good to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. Happy New Year. Thank you for joining us. We are also joined. We're also joined today by labor activist and author Jane McAlevey. Jane argues that the key to resisting Donald Trump is getting outside the echo chamber of existing activist networks, tapping into the disruptive power of ordinary and organized people. Jane McAlevey is a labor organizer and author of Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the American Labor Movement. Her latest book is No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. Jane will be talking about her book on Wednesday, January 11th from 6:30 to 8 at UC Berkeley's Labor Center, 12521 Channing Way in Berkeley. And for more information, you can visit yourcallradio.org. And Jane joins us in studio. Hi, Jane. Happy New Year. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Before we talk about the best ways to resist Donald Trump, I wanted to ask you both sort of a personal question, and that is, how do people shake themselves out of this despair and find the strength to organize? Because when you look at Donald Trump's agenda, when you look at the people that he has appointed, this is very extreme, especially if you're a woman and a person of color. It's pretty scary. And I've talked to a lot of people over the last 2 weeks who said, I'm trying to get myself out of this to have the energy to fight. Reverend Forbes, I'll start with you. You've been traveling. You've been talking to people. What are you telling people who are really feeling despair right now?
Well, first of all, as a preacher, you know I had to talk during the Christmas and Hanukkah season. And so the first thing I said to people is, guess what, folks? Hanukkah and Christmas all come in the winter. Well, we had an early winter as of November 8th and 9th. That was a really chilly wind that blew with revelation that things had gone in a different way than even the pollsters had suggested. So I told them, guess what? When it gets winter like this, you must go ahead and grieve about the chilly winds, but don't hang in there too long. Get ready for the winter spectacular. I always say, listen, folks, it is when there is the backdrop of oppression, the backdrop of brutality, that people of faith are encouraged to look for signs of some manifestation of overcoming grace. So that's what I did during Christmas. So people, forget it. Christmas comes in the winter. It is winter. Now let's sign up to be part of the winter spectacular of amazing grace, which is basically designed to say we cannot hover into depression for so long. We have a right to cry, to moan and groan, and then get up and ask ourselves, what are the ways in which, having been given clarity about the repressive elements in the nation, we now find ourselves renewed in our commitment to pursue the dream of Dr. King, the dream of the beloved community, the dream that even is sometimes referred to, again, as the American dream. So that's what I try to do. That one of the antidotes to the negativity is to remind ourselves of what we were fighting for all along, and that we view the current assault against democracy as an attack against a movement that was already underway for justice for all God's people, the pursuit of the common good.
Jane, what would you add to that?
Well, first of all, as the good Reverend said, you know, we can't actually afford to not get up and fight at this point. So, you know, right after the day of the election, I had to fly to Philadelphia, where I was involved in labor negotiations. Actually, there were thousands of workers there, you know, waiting for their negotiator to show up and get back at the table and take the negotiations table with them against a fairly ruthless employer. And the whole day as I was flying there, I was getting emails from folks on the ground saying people are really depressed, they're really down, they're basically, they don't know what to do. And I had to walk in the next day, you know, a day after the election in the state of Pennsylvania, in a swing state, and say to people, look, I'm sorry, this is a horrible moment in our lifetimes, probably worst single moment in my actual lifetime. But the truth is, get out of fetal position, get up, make a plan, make a strategy, talk to your friends, and get it together. Because there isn't actually time for us to sit around feeling depressed when there is a struggle to happen. They moved last night already. They, the extreme right wing in Congress, attempted to move last night. And, you know, as a sign of possibly just a good times, in the last 25 minutes, the act to destroy the Office of Ethics was already rebuffed. And I just read a tweet from someone that said, resistance one, GOP zero. So this is a long struggle. The Reverend knows this is a long struggle. We got to be in this for the long game, and people have to get up, get out of their depression, and figure out how they're going to contribute to rolling back the agenda of a crazy, really extreme corporate class.
Give us a quick overview of what happened with the Ethics Commission.
Oh, my God. I mean, there were people who were occupying congressional offices already this morning, and that's exactly what's going to have to happen. So I saw one email that was a reflection of a bunch of activists in Maine who, at the crack of dawn, like, went and took over and occupied a congressional office. So there were people in motion already this morning, just from last night to this morning. That's an example of mobilizing. And in the short term, the focus of the program that you're doing today and this week, in the short term, we've got to do stuff just like that. Immediate mobilization, quick mobilization, effective mobilization. People were out there taking over offices this morning, shutting down switchboards, and literally reversed the first action of an extreme right-wing agenda, which was last night, which was to destroy the Ethics Commission, the Independent Ethics Commission. It got rolled back. People didn't think it was going to happen this morning, and it actually just happened. So that's an encouraging sign that says, get up, get out of your chair, because people just did it this morning.
Wow. And Reverend Forbes, we'll talk about the long term and what we can learn from history. But since Jane just brought this breaking news to us, and talked about short-term activism, that people were right away ready to go occupy these offices. What are your thoughts on the most effective way to organize in the short term?
Basically, the revival has already started talking. Strangely enough, it was a moral high ground we were talking about in those 20 states that we went through from April of last year up until April of this year up until the election. So it was fascinating to see that the first assault was to ethics. That is to say, we don't want to be held to any standards. We're going to deregulate in regards to policy. We're going to deregulate in regards to morality. So what we did is we started having people do direct action in states across the nation. So people during the autumn of this year, before election came up, had already, as in September, had the opportunity to do direct action. The most significant word to be said is coordination of action is the only way we can stand up to the assault against the values we've always had. There's no time for splicing all of the fine details of my organization, who's going to fund me, who's going to fund the other. We must put together a massive movement of coalition building with focus on where the pressure points are. And if our opposition has taught us anything, they think ahead and they think in terms of strategies for the long term. At every point of the assertion of an assault, we have to have troops on the ground, and we are basically nonviolent in our approach. We've got to have demonstrations, labor gets together with not-for-profits and not-for-profits get together with fraternities and fraternities get together with churches. Let's recognize that we have a common enemy, and that is the enemy against the common good. Therefore, we must be stronger in our togetherness than we've ever been before.
Reverend James Forbe is Senior Minister Emeritus at the Riverside Church in New York and co-chair of the Moral Revival. This is a national tour that was launched to advance a broad social justice agenda. And for the last 6 months of the year, they traveled to over 20 states. We're also joined by labor activist and author Jane McAlevey. Her latest book is No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. She'll be speaking on Wednesday, January 11th at 6:30 at UC Berkeley's Labor Center. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. It's our first live show of the year. Happy New Year. We're going to be kicking off a week of shows talking about how ordinary citizens, activists, and grassroots organizations are preparing to resist Donald Trump and his party's extreme agenda. And we'd love to hear from you. What do you think are the most effective ways to go about this, short-term, long-term? If you've been doing this work for decades, what lessons have you learned over the years? And if you're kind of feeling like, I just don't know if I'm up for the fight, we'd love to hear from you, because I think that's a really part of this important part of this discussion. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. To that point, we have an email from Carolyn who says, for the first time in my voting life, I feel like dropping out. The Electoral College is supposed to protect the nation from tyranny by majority, but what about tyranny of the minority? Trump was not elected with the popular vote. His behavior, comments, and plans just seem to be getting worse. I don't know what good a protest will do. The majority did not vote for him. Obviously, they've made their views known. Trump doesn't care. What are your thoughts, Jane?
So two things. One is, in some ways, I agree with a couple of things that the person you just emailed in said, which is, if we think that protests alone are sufficient, we're dead wrong. And part of what I talk about in the new book is, again, what does it mean to build for the long term? How do we actually build power in the long term? So there's been a lot of debate about the Electoral College, right, obviously, since the election. And I've heard people saying we need to, you know, overturn and abolish the Electoral College. That's all great. The truth is we don't have anywhere near the power we need to do that. So there's two different things we have to do. One is there is a need for protest right now. That's what happened this morning that rolled back the first attack by the right wing against the concept of ethics. So protest matters as a short-term strategy, as a defensive strategy. But much more interesting, and I think much more important in the long term, is what does it mean to rebuild a powerful base of people in this country that I argue in the new book we've let wither, that in the last sort of 35 to 40 years, it's actually the corporate right with funding from groups like the Koch brothers who got together and began to do what I think of as sort of a back-to-basics organizing approach, which prioritizes making relationships with people who you don't know, making relationships with people who aren't the ones who are talking to you. They're not in our Twitter feeds. They're not on Facebook. They're the people who are not involved and don't see themselves and don't self-identify yet as sort of with us in this movement in a sort of moral economic crusade for justice in this country. So I think if all we think about doing is protesting, that's a limitation of our thinking. But it's also essential. Like right now, there's a need, an urgent need for a lot of protests. That's what's called a mobilizing model, and we have to get a lot of people doing it. But in the long term, to the point of that person who emailed in, I want to encourage her to think about investigating what it means to do something called serious base building, serious long-term organizing, which is, in fact, a different approach than going to a protest. So we have to do both. It's not one or the other. My argument in the new book is that, unfortunately, we've mostly been doing the latter. We've mostly been doing protest, and we've let a very what used to be a very broad working class base, and by working class, I mean black, brown, white, women, everything, the actual working class. We've let that base wither, believing that tweeting and Facebook and a whole bunch of shortcuts would sort of get us there. And I'm arguing it's part of why we have Donald Trump right now. So it's both. It's protest, but it's also a very different approach to going out and devoting a lot of energy and attention, as faith leaders do and as trade union leaders do. The two places where we see an outreach to people who wouldn't normally be in our Twitter feeds are, frankly, in the House of Labor and in the faith community. And I think we've got to really double down and look at our history and realize that we've got to put some serious energy back into that kind of work.
You are on the ground with the people organizing, and this really didn't surprise you like it did so many others.
Yeah, unfortunately, it didn't surprise me. I was in Pennsylvania. I was involved in a very dynamic, very wonderful union organizing campaign that was going on concurrent to the election. And I have to say, in some ways, I'm probably not on the ground in fetal position, because thousands of workers in Pennsylvania just formed new unions and won concurrent to what was happening. So when people talk about, you know, the working class sort of siding with Donald Trump, I think that's a bunch of crap. I was just in a swing state where the working class was making a very different decision. And the question was, what's our approach? What's our strategy? What's our power structure analysis? I think there's no question that the vast majority of people in this country are actually with us and against the minority who stand with Trump. And it was our failure as a movement, and I certainly the failure of the Democratic Party, to understand what needed to be done, not just as a campaign, but fundamentally at a policy level. The Democratic Party just abandoned the working class and walked away from them. Again, by that, I don't mean – some people think when you say working class, it means white. That's what Trump is trying to do to that word. The working class is anything but white. I mean, it's white, it's black, it's brown, it's women, it's everyone, basically, who isn't in the top, you know, 10%. And there's no question that a majority of those folks are sort of with a more progressive agenda, and it's a failure of our movement that we've allowed that base to wither.
Reverend Forbes, can you talk a little bit about failures and what you have learned from the failures of the last year?
The first failure was that we were so busy, who are the progressives, celebrating the obvious victory we were going to have, that we forgot some of the other people who were actually feeling increasingly ignored, left out, and set aside. It's what a shame that we allowed those people to be recruited by the propaganda of the other side. Isn't it awful to be able to say that there was a whole segment of our society that felt like the rest of us were their adversaries, which allowed the propaganda of the political elite to give them the wrong scapegoats? They had those people thinking that the immigrants were their problem, that the black people were their problem, that gay people were their problem, that women were their problem. It was our lack of a sensitivity and awareness that many of those people are actually the increasing part of the death statistics are related to white working class non-educated people out there in the middle of this country that we just simply ignored. Well, we don't have to do that ever again. We must begin to recognize that if you're talking about disenfranchised, that the coalition is not racial, it is not sexual orientation, it is really not even citizenship in terms of border between the South and the North. We must understand that the fresh organizing has to say there are a whole lot of us that are being shafted by the elites who are taking most of the resources of this nation and leaving the rest of us with the crumbs that fall from the table. We've got the largest gathering of people to be put into a coalition that's interested in establishing fundamental rights in the courts, fundamental rights with respect to jobs, education, that kind of thing. So my experience is it's a shame to get locked into thinking that you have a constituency and that your constituency is the little handful of people that have your identity. No. We've got to be global citizens and recognize that the problematics determine who should be in coalition. And it seems to me that most of us who are Americans are a part of a problematic when we look at the exploitation from the billionaires of the world. Therefore, my experience is, don't get caught thinking you know who your party members are. Your party members are folks that are struggling, folks that are trying to realize the American dream, but discovering that the forces are against them and that we plan to work together. Secondly, don't forget the vision of what you're already working on. Do not spend all of our time. Now, we got to have some watchdogs about what is being done by the new administration. But we need to be renewed in our sense of what our vision is. For an example, I'm going to be encouraging churches, mosques, and synagogues to have a period in their order of worship where they can stop and have something what I call what's going on. What is going on in this community that is seeking to undermine the liberties, the freedoms, and the rights of most of our people? Well, why don't you stop clapping and singing 10 minutes and have a chance to have people discuss what's going on and have in every church a people that are interested in translating the general vision of religious idealism into practical action steps towards mobilizing people against being shafted by those who have already dismissed them. Organization, you've got the religious institutions. And last year, I think many of us went to sleep. And one of my friends on the revival, Tracy Blackman, said the young people tell her, say, listen, stay woke. The grammar may be present, but the attitude is right. Stay alert. But don't just stay alert. Get off of your knees and go out and organize so that, but organize after you've done some strategizing. And right now, knee-jerk emotional reactions won't be enough. We've got to have some good mind saying, this is a pressure point, and if we are vigilant in the next year, 2 years, 3 years, or the next 10 years, for heaven, if we stay this course, we can turn things around.
Jane, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I'm nodding my head, absolutely, because I think two things are true. One is, what we know is that there are two institutions only in the history, in the modern history of America, and modern, I mean, the last 150 years or so. There are two institutions only that have had a positive impact on sort of working class voting patterns. And it's faith, meaning religion, and it's trade unions. And I think what we've seen in the last 40 years or so is one, a pronounced attack on trade unions, one which many liberals, and I want to come back to this in a minute, but many liberals walk away. Like when you hear liberals talking about, oh, civil society, they talk about women and Black Lives Matter, and they talk about, you know, climate change, and there's this word missing, which is called the right of the working class to build organization inside their workplace and fight for themselves. That's called a union. But there's never been a moment when faith and unions weren't at the foundational core of us building power in this country. And mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. I think we have to return to, in the beginning of the new book, I outline the history of the civil rights movement as based inside of the Black church in the Jim Crow era and the trade union movement in the 30s and 40s. And I outline how we built the kind of power because those two institutions are really different. They are really different than sort of the activist circuit that people feel good in, right? It's like I say, we have to spend most of our time having very uncomfortable conversations with people who, again, are not in our Twitter feed, so, and are not in our activist cell, and are not in our something. So to me, I'm nodding my head because there's nothing more important than faith and trade unions. And what's interesting is for people who consider themselves liberals, a lot of them might embrace, some basically may, but a lot of them will embrace all these other causes. But they actually will look askew. A lot of people consider themselves sort of liberals, will look askew maybe even at the House of Faith sometimes. Frankly, I've heard a lot of that in my lifetime. And they definitely look askew at unions. And it's a misunderstanding of everything that we've won in this country that's good has come from a civil rights movement based in the Black church and a working class movement based in a structure called trade unions. And people think, oh, we needed those things back then. And what they didn't understand is that the minute we took our eye off the prize, which was about the early 1970s, an organized corporate right-wing force came in and formed the Christian Coalition and a whole bunch of institutions that came to attack the evangelical church was raised up in part to go after the power of the black church, right? So they built a grassroots organization. You know, the Koch brothers right now have an academy called the Grassroots Leadership Academy, which I've been studying. And if you went to the Grassroots Leadership Academy and if you changed out the issue set, you would realize that they've taken a page from what was the best work in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s in this country. And they're applying it to building their own grassroots army at the same time that we're sitting around thinking that protests and Twitter and Facebook is going to solve our problem, and it's not.
And Dr. King would agree with you. Where would the movement have been were it not for coming together of labor as well as people of faith? You were exactly right on that point.
Well, Reverend Forbes, final thoughts before we let you go?
The only thing I want to say, yes, I want to say, listen, folks, the Holy Spirit, see, I'm a preacher. The Spirit has had an agenda a long time. People forget that as soon as the Spirit came on Pentecost, a new form of egalitarian community began to develop. So folks need to recognize, stop talking about the Holy Spirit as if it's only about feel good. The Holy Spirit has to do with liberation on all levels. Jesus talked about the Spirit's on me because he had anointed me to preach good news to the poor, to set the captives free, to give liberty, and to say right now is the time we want to do this. That is the acceptable year of the Lord. So my final word would be, folks, get with the real Spirit. Get some energy, and then get some strategy, and then get some coalition, and let's look forward with a smile on our face. God's got something up her sleeve, and if folks think we're going to lie down or either simply shout ourselves the glory, forget it. We are here to stay, and things are going to change, not in the next administration. They're going to change during this administration because we are going to stay alert. We're going to stay active, and we're going to stay together.
Reverend James Forbes is Senior Minister Emeritus of the Riverside Church in New York and co-chair of the Moral Revival. Reverend Forbes, we'd love to have you back, and thank you for joining us.
My joy.
Thank you. And you can find more information about the Moral Revival. This was a national tour that was launched to advance social justice issues like the economic liberation of all people, healthcare access for all, criminal justice reform. And last year, members traveled to over 20 states from April until the end of the year. And coming up after the break, we'll continue our conversation with Jane McAlevey, labor activist. Her latest book is No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. She will be discussing her book Wednesday, January 11th. From 6:30 to 8 at UC Berkeley's Labor Center, 12521 Channing Way in Berkeley. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question or idea you'd like, or an experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may leave a comment at the show's website, set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org, and you can also tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11 o'clock in a half an hour, it's the BBC's World Have Your Say here on 91.7 KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Happy New Year. Today we are kicking off our first week of shows talking about how organizations and ordinary citizens are planning to resist Donald Trump. Tomorrow we'll talk about how California politicians are going to resist Trump. California Democrats gained 2/3 of the seats in both state houses. Now they have a supermajority. They can act without Republican input and pass bills that will go into effect immediately. A number of bills have already been introduced, mostly focusing on immigration. So we hope you can tune in tomorrow to hear about California Dems. And today we are kicking off our first day, first show of the year, with Jane McAlevey. She's a labor activist and author. Her latest book is No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. Jane will be on later in the month to talk specifically about her book. She'll also be discussing it Wednesday, January 11th from 6:30 to 8 at UC Berkeley's Labor Center. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on resisting Donald Trump? What do you think is most effective? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Jane, I want to ask you about union members and Democrats who voted for Donald Trump. Bernie Sanders took part in a really interesting town hall with union members who voted for Donald Trump, and they said that they were either going to vote for Bernie or Trump. You've been on the ground. What are you hearing from union members who voted for Trump?
Well, let me just back up and say again. I think one of the failures of our imagination, and this goes to national labor leadership, was that if you were out working with workers in this country for the last couple of years, from the minute that Bernie Sanders opened his mouth, it was very clear that the grassroots base within trade unions was in favor of Bernie Sanders. And despite this, you saw a number of the national unions rush very, very quickly to endorse Hillary Clinton. And at some point, a part of what has to happen is that rank-and-file trade unionists have to themselves be empowered and empower themselves and learn how to actually do that to take on their national leadership. Because I don't think that the decision to endorse Hillary Clinton by a lot of the national unions in any way reflected the rank and file base of workers inside of those organizations. So I had the pleasure of working with a union all this year that actually endorsed Sanders. And it was fascinating because, you know, we were in the middle of doing what's called a new organizing campaign, which means, again, bringing in workers who had never been in a union, never probably self-identified. I could tell you, of the 5,300 of them involved, very few of them would ever have considered themselves activists or involved or been able to. And there was a point when people were concerned that we were really out there on the Sanders campaign, and would that be like a detriment? Would the bosses be able to use it, meaning the employers, in their very vicious anti-union campaign that they were running against us? And the Sanders thing not only wasn't an issue in a campaign by the bosses to try and stop workers from forming new unions in Pennsylvania, but it was clear that, if anything, the idea that the union had endorsed Sanders actually helped with a lot of grassroots working class folks in Pennsylvania who were involved in forming unions. So, I mean, I think we put up a terrible candidate. That's, you know, that we could debate, you know, all the many reasons why we lost. But at the end of the day, we lost. If you look at the existing system, forget about the system that we want. There's a system that we want that's fair, that has money out of politics, that has no electoral college, all that stuff. But in the system that we have, which if we're strategists, we have to deal a little bit with the system that we have. In the system that we, which is part of what Bernie did, right, different than Ralph Nader. In the system that we have, Sanders, first of all, ran inside of the two-party system, which I frankly celebrated. I was never excited about Ralph Nader's campaigns only because in the system that we have, you have to deal with the two-party system. And so him running for a primary challenge inside the Democratic Party, I thought was brilliant, quite frankly. And that was controversial when he started it, right? Some people who were sort of more to the left were being critical of that. And I think it was brilliant. As someone who's, I've spent a lot of my adult life doing what's called primarying bad Democrats, which I say is a target-rich environment any day of the week, right? So, but the way that you win in this country still is inside of a two-party system. Do we want to change it? Absolutely. But so we put up a bad candidate. If you look at the Electoral College, there's so many debates about who won, why did it happen, what are the variables, and there's a lot of them. But frankly, we lost three states that we didn't need to lose. We lost them on the teeniest of margins, which were crucial states in the Midwest that are union strong states. And I think Bernie Sanders would have taken all those states. In fact, I think he mostly did take those states in the primaries. So, you know, we have a lot of internal issues to grapple with along the way to building a better, smarter strategic movement.
And so these union members that you worked with and then the union brass, what is their plan to resist Donald Trump?
You know, look, a lot of those same leaders will be out there on the front line of doing the immediate defense work. What they won't do, unfortunately, yet, is grapple with the larger failure of the decisions they've made in the last couple of years. And, you know, I like to jokingly say about some of the national leadership, and certainly at the Democratic Party, but also in some of our national unions, you know, workers get fired for far less stupid decision-making than the decisions that a bunch of folks in this country just made. And it's time for a lot of them to, frankly, retire and move over and get out of the way. Because I'm in the rank and file, and you can see this in places like the Chicago Teachers Union. You can see it in a whole bunch of – even here, right, in Los Angeles. There's been a crusade by a bunch of really smart progressive teachers who actually assume the leadership of the Los Angeles Teachers Union. And they're brilliant, and they're great. And so we see evidence – all over the country, that rank-and-file workers are realizing the first thing they have to do is get control of their own organization. And in order to do that, the best workers have to step forward and decide unions are a very powerful institution in this country still, despite how weak they are. Mm-hmm. They're still the strongest, along with the House of Faith, right? Brother from Riverside Church we just had on. The two institutions that remarkably are still the strongest in a very weak movement are trade unions and religious institutions. So, I think that the leadership that made the decision to go all out for Hillary Clinton, who spent hundreds of millions of dollars trying to elect a candidate that you couldn't get a single, barely, you couldn't get many people in a room that I was in excited about, need to be held accountable for that bad decision making. They're going to do the right thing right now. They already are. They're standing up. They're putting the resources out there. But the fundamental question of accountability to bad decision making is one that good people who are members of unions who have maybe never been involved in their union before, they need to step up, get involved, run for local office in their unions, take it over, and make a better labor movement, because we need a better labor movement and we need it now.
We have a number of people on the line. Let's go through a few calls and then we'll get Jane to respond. Let's hear from Kim in San Francisco. Hi, Kim. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to say that a few weeks ago when I first heard about the March on Washington for Women, I immediately signed up. But I never thought about going as a protest. I see it as going as a demonstration for what I'm for. And I think if we're going to reach out to some of the people that voted for Trump, we need to say what we're for, aren't you with it too? And when Trump makes his mistakes, we don't need to say, I told you so. We need to say, see, he lied to you. Join me. That's just my comment of how we need to go forward.
All right, thank you. And in a few minutes, we're going to be joined by one of the co-founders of the Women's March in Washington. We'll get responses in just a minute, but thank you for calling, Kim. Let's go next to Marta in Oakland. Hi, Marta. Welcome to the show.
Hello. This is me. Thank you. And I think the guests and the subject are so important. And thank you for having this program. No, my thought was that I came out to Berkeley from the East Coast, from having worked at the Harvard Business School and seeing for the first time labor leaders and business executives putting their arms around each other as they walked down the paths and taking courses together. That was the start of sort of an intertwining. But when I came out here and Reagan was governor, what I wanted to say was,
oh, I'm sorry, Marta. Bad line. Sorry about that. Let's go. And if we have a better line, give us a call back, and we'll put you on in the front. Let's go next to Sydney in San Francisco. Hi, Sydney.
Hi. I'm really glad you're doing this show, and I think my response to the election was very much like the one you're demonstrating today. And your guests are certainly supporting. I'm an Elizabeth Warren Democrat, and I voted for Bernie, and I am a teacher of teachers of young children. So I've been using my Facebook page, which is Sydney Clemens, Sydney Gerwitz Clemens, to give people who are raising children and teaching young children materials to help them get through this. This is a very scary time for people who are too young to really understand it. There is a wonderful flyer that I keep putting up, written by someone who calls herself Senora Tarman Teacher, which goes, "Dear undocumented students, in this classroom there are no walls. You belong here. You are loved. Dear black students in this classroom, your life matters. You are loved. Dear Muslim students and students of Middle East." It goes on through Mexican and female and LGBTQ. and all students, and I put it up for people to put on their classroom walls to help us all get through this. I also have a real respect for what Van Jones is doing. More than 60,000 people have joined his Love Army, and I'm inviting everyone to go look at that webpage. I think it, I think you go to Dream Corps. And
well, Sydney, thank you for all of those resources, and we'll put up some of them right after the show at yourcallradio.org. Let's take a few more callers. Ruby in Mill Valley. Hi, Ruby. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. I'm so happy with your guest comments and energy and enthusiasm. Every conversation I've been having since November 8th is, okay, the election is over. We've got to deal with this as it is now. And what about 4 years from now? And I get sort of blank looks. And we reelected George Bush, George W. We didn't think we were going to, but we did. So I'm really concerned about the next election. I feel like we're way behind already. Can we not find the billionaires of like-minded people with Bernie Sanders and possibly Elizabeth Warren to establish a leadership academy vis-a-vis the Koch brothers group? Can't we find that? Can't we develop good candidates, candidates who care about public service and are transparent as much as we can be, who aren't disingenuous, which I felt Hillary was?
Thanks, Ruby. Jane?
Oh, yeah. Well, let me just start right on Ruby's good comments. One is, I just want to say for the record, since I was deep in the Florida recount back in 2000, I don't know that we ever elected Bush, to be perfectly honest. I think he stole both elections, but on the margins, but that's a detail. So I also don't think we elected Trump, right? I just call it regime change. But so I think that Ruby is right. And what I want to say that I think is potentially encouraging is that the stories I tell in the new book are about rebuilding internally organizations very quickly. And I think that it can happen very quickly. And so each of the stories I tell, one of them is about the Chicago Teachers Union, you know, which is a union that went from being moribund, okay, pathetic. There's a lot of them out there, like a target-rich environment for bad Democrats in office. And it's ours to change. So, but in the Chicago Teachers Union, they changed around, you know, the third largest teachers union in the country in a matter of a few years. So if we do it right, we've got the ability to do it. When I was leading a union in Nevada, we turned around a union that was moribund and bad again, also, and frankly, 2 years, right? So when we do, in part, as the good reverend who was on the call with us earlier mentioned, which is get some strategy, I would add, before you get your strategy, get some power structure analysis done, figure out what you really need to do and who's holding the power and what you got to do about it. And then get your strategy aligned. And that strategy has to, in this country, have more to do with devoting most of our energy to reaching out to and working with people, again, who are not talking to us. So, Ruby, it can actually happen really fast. Good strategy, when we do it right, can happen really fast. And I want to say one more thing about the first caller who talked about the sort of the what we're for, which I think is also really great. I don't to be a successful union organizer, let me just say the title of my first book, which was Raising Expectations. That is an entire book about keeping focused on what it is we're fighting for. Negative campaigning and being negative brings no one but negative people with you, and that's not the majority. So I would just say to the first caller, the entire first book I wrote, of which even just that title was sort of a battle with my publisher at the time. They were like, what does that title mean? And I said, if people don't have their basic expectations raised that we can get ourselves out of this mess, that there's a plan to get us out of this pathetic, disgusting mess that we find ourselves in, then they're going to just go fetal on the floor and not do anything, right? So I agree with her. We have to talk about what's the common ground for what we stand for, not just what we're fighting against.
Right. Well, and on that note, what we are standing for, and thank you, Ruby, for calling in, I'd like to now welcome Evie Harmon to the show. She's co-founder and national co-organizer of the Women's March on Washington. And you may have heard that on the day after the inauguration on January 21st, a huge march will be taking place in Washington at 10 a.m. There's one in San Francisco, 4 to 6, Oakland, 10 o'clock, San Jose, 10 o'clock, Sacramento, 10 o'clock. I mean, these marches are taking place all over the country. Hi, Evie. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's talk about this, Evie. This march has come together very quickly. Tens of thousands of people have already RSVP'd. 29 organizations at this point are involved: Planned Parenthood, Amnesty International, the American Indian Movement. Talk a little bit about what this march is for and what you're hoping to accomplish.
Well, this whole movement was inspired by a woman in Hawaii named Teresa Shook. And the day after the election, she sent out a private invite to 40 of her friends, a call to action to march on Washington January the 21st, specifically geared to women. But it's an all-inclusive march. We welcome our brothers as well. So basically, it went viral. It grew exponentially for the first week. And I got involved that very first night that the invite went out. And it was very apparent to us in the first 72 hours that this had actually become a global movement. As of now, we have about 180 marches that we're aware of between the United States and the rest of the world. So really, the last 8 weeks to the day tomorrow has been about just trying to get a hold of this network that has sprung up so organically. And the hope is that we can use these connections and these relationships that we have fostered over the last 8 weeks to continue the work past January 22nd, whether that be a local action that affects your community, whether it be a state action that California can go after, whether it be actions that's geared towards the United States and the 3 to 5 legislative actions we're going to go after as Women's March, all the way to tackling global problems like climate change.
And Evie, have you been involved in politics before?
Actually, I have not. I follow politics. I have been a grassroots organizer pretty much any time that I can get my hands on an action. The last major thing I did was in 2008. I mobilized South Carolina in solidarity with Join the Impact to fight the passing of Proposition 8 in California. Hmm.
So, Jane, what are your thoughts on this? 180 marches across the country. It kind of reminds me of the women's march that we had right after George W. Bush took office. I went there to do interviews, and there were grandparents from Kentucky. I mean, people from all over the country converged on Washington to send a message specifically about abortion, because at that point, a lot of people thought Roe was kind of on the hook, and we're thinking the same thing this time around.
Roe is definitely on the hook.
Yeah.
But Roe and a lot more than that, right, than that is on the hook. So, you know, again, I'm all for protest at this moment, and I'm for strategic protest. And there are times when, frankly, we need to just come together, remind ourselves that we're not crazy, that there are millions of people who are standing with us. We need to yell and chant and scream and feel good. And a huge turnout would be a really nice rebuke to the man who on that bus talked about grabbing our you-know-whats. So I think it's great, and I'm planning on going, for sure. And so are many women that I know. But my, as an organizer, you know, my ongoing concern is what happens next. Mm. What's the follow-up? How do we translate protest into long-term strategic action? And I want to just remind folks again that from the history of liberating girls who were burned in the Triangle factory in the early 1900s in this country, the single organization that has done more to liberate and economically empower women in this country than any single institution is organized labor and trade unions. And when we forget that, we're in trouble. So I hope that part of the call for the march is going to be a virulent defense of teachers' unions, which are made up of lots of women of color, and public service unions that are made up of, if you look at the coming attack right now, the biggest attack that's going to go in some ways directly at a lot of women is the very constructed narrative that the corporate right has against quote-unquote government unions. And if you look at the single best sort of jobs that women and women of color have in this country, like maintaining good middle-class stable jobs, it's public service unions. That's where most women and women of color have found middle-class safety in this country. And the right wing is coming straight at them, along with Roe v. Wade. So while we're focused on Roe, I want to focus on defense of the biggest liberating institution of women in this country, and that's trade unions.
Evie, are many trade union organizations involved in the Women's March?
You know, to be completely honest with you, that is not my lane. That is definitely a conversation for Carmen and Paula. They are our goddesses that are getting all of these fantastic partnerships on board. My job has been from the beginning to try to coordinate all of the different volunteers from around the world so that we get our messaging, the same. We don't want, the San Francisco March to be marching under one message, which, might be anti-Trump, which is something that we have said from the beginning. We cannot be a movement. A movement can't be about one man. We cannot make this a protest against Donald Trump. It has to be a movement for rights, for equality, for change, for contacting your elected officials and pressuring them to make sure that we don't lose Roe v. Wade and that we don't go backwards on so many issues that we have fought so long and hard to acquire.
There was actually a focus group conducted with Trump voters, and when they were told that the plan was to gut Planned Parenthood, they were outraged by this. A lot of them didn't even know that was on the agenda.
Yeah, but, Planned Parenthood is an incredible organization. And so one thing that we should be doing is definitely supporting Planned Parenthood. They are an example of an organization that has figured out how not to lead with Roe, not to lead on a divisive issue, but to lead with the fundamental services that they provide, which are, in fact, about women's health. And along the way, they're also providing other essential services. But part of what's so beautiful about Planned Parenthood is, frankly, that they're focused on working-class women. I mean, if you look at Roe right now, in the number of states that have created enormous, there's a number of states, right, that have figured out how to create incredible barriers to women's choice. But what we know is that sort of, frankly, white upper middle class or white wealthy women can still go pull the trigger that they need to do, wherever they want. They can get the kind of services, whether it's abortion services or anything else, that most low-income women in this country can't. Mm. And so to me, Planned Parenthood is an example of an organization that is doing a whole lot of things correctly.
Jane McAlevey is a labor activist and the author of two books. Her latest is No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. Jane will be discussing her book on Wednesday, January 11th from 6:30 to 8 at UC Berkeley's Labor Center. And I actually got the address wrong earlier. The right one is 2521 Channing Way in Berkeley. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. And Evie Harmon is co-founder and national co-organizer for the Women's March in Washington. They're going to be marches all over the country on January 21st. Check yourcallradio.org for more information. Evie and Jane, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And coming up tomorrow, we will talk about how California legislators are planning to resist Donald Trump and his administration. California Democrats gained 2/3 of the seats in both state houses, giving them a supermajority needed to act without Republican input. So what legislation would you like them to introduce and pass? That is tomorrow. I hope you can join us for that. Your Call is produced at KALW. To listen to our shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Helena Murphy is our researcher. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance was today's studio engineer. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.